Well, the smell of cut grass is really one of the pleasures of summer, and the feel of a cool lawn under your feet on a hot day is just heaven. But there's a cost associated with a uniform, weed-free lawn. How can we minimize how many chemicals are being added to not only our home environment, but possibly community water sources as well? Hi, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining us for another edition of Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest today can help us find the right balance for the kind of lawn we want and how we want to take care of it. Doug Soldat is an associate professor of soil science at UW-Madison. He teaches, among other things, turf grass nutrient and water management. Doug, great to have you back with us on Garden Talk.
Thanks, Judith. Great to be here.
And, you know, it's people always want to talk about lawns because it can be a real challenge to have the kind of lawn you want, but also, you know, to keep in mind those things like how many chemicals you're using and how much water you might be using. Last year certainly was, you know, at some point I think people just had to kind of give up on watering the lawns because there was no way we were going to be able to keep up with the drought. Anyway, this year it seems like we're having an opposite problem, and we'll talk about that. But first, let's talk about what turf grass is. What are the kinds of plants that you're dealing with as a turf grass specialist?
Yeah, one of the first questions I ask the students in our introduction to turf grass management is, what is turf? Okay,
mm-hmm.
So and blank stares across the board. And these are people who have worked on golf courses and stuff for quite a while. So we don't often think, what is turf mean? And turf, definition of turf is a contiguous ground cover that persists under constant traffic or mowing.
Hmm.
So
okay.
It has to be, it's not specific to a grass. So it's any type of plant that if you mow it or graze it or traffic it, it's still going to maintain 100% ground cover. So that's
okay.
The definition of a turf. Turf grass is simply a grass that can form a turf.
Okay.
And so having that dense ground cover under that traffic and mowing is a really unique feature. So there's thousands of grass species, but there's only a few handful that are turf grasses that
because,
form that dense cover.
Yeah, I'm guessing some like some of the native grasses are clumps instead of having that. I think of it as that interlocking root system where you can't just pull up an inch. It's you're kind of committing to taking up a whole swath of it if you try to get
exactly
under
like
it.
A carpet. And you can think of if you've seen clover, where it's just only clover. Clover is a turf forming plant too.
Hmm.
So there's just a few of them that can do that, but it's a pretty unique feature.
So you talked about that handful of grasses that actually can form a turf. What are the most common ones that we see in the upper Midwest?
So yeah, in the upper Midwest for lawns, we're really only talking about Kentucky bluegrass, fine fescues, which are four or five really, really closely related species of fescue grasses. So Kentucky bluegrass, fine fescues, tall fescue, perennial ryegrass.
Hmm.
And that's about it.
Wow.
So the best grass in general for the state of Wisconsin is going to be Kentucky bluegrass. It's most adapted to our conditions here. And it tends to be the dominant grass that we find in lawns around Wisconsin.
And how would you describe that Kentucky bluegrass for people who might not be sure what they have out in that lawn?
Yeah, grass identification is really difficult. I mean, the way that plant scientists usually identify plants is by the flower. And you only get a flower when you stop mowing. And since we're always in that vegetative state, we have to look at these really tiny features on the grass to tell them apart. And it can be done, but it's really difficult to do. So in general, we talk about those grass mix, the fine fescue, perennial ryegrass, and Kentucky bluegrass usually just being a mixed in most lawns.
And so things like crabgrass or quackgrass, that's not really a turf.
Yeah, those are weeds that come in. You can get quackgrass will form a turf, but crabgrass really won't. And so crabgrass is thin and clumpy and one of the reasons that we don't use it as a lawn species.
We're talking with Doug Soldat about taking care of our lawns, and especially taking care of our lawns with an eye to minimizing how much water and chemical fertilizers or herbicides that we might need to use. So finding that balance of having the kind of lawn that we'd like to have, but also minimizing any potential risks or damages. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also send us an email to talk@wpr.org. And we'd also love to have you post a question, a comment, or a photo of your lawn on our Facebook page. That's The Larry Mueller Show. Mueller is spelled M-E-I-L-L-E. ER, and Doug will be happy to answer your questions. Now, last year, as we mentioned earlier, Doug, the drought was such an issue for all kinds of gardens and yards, but certainly, I mean, there were lawns that looked like somebody had set fire to them because basically the sun had. And a lot of people, you know, just had to kind of give up on them for the year. Now, here we are, you know, the next spring. What kind of damage are you hearing about that was a consequence of that drought?
Yeah, last year was really bad. And so one thing that we always encourage people to do is if you have damage, repair it in the fall. And that's a time when a lot of the competing weeds aren't really germinating. So fall is the best time to repair that damage. Last fall, we got another little drought that came through. So I think of people that went out and tried to put down seed and aerate and do some things to recover because it was so dry, probably was not successful. So this year, what we're seeing out there is pretty good recovery overall. Hmm. I mean, when I walk around the neighborhood and drive around the county and state, I'm seeing mostly green grass.
Wow.
Almost every spot, every lawn has patches of stuff that didn't come back. And in the place of that lawn, what was there is now usually weeds. So we're seeing increased weed pressure this year and still some pretty thin turf out there. But overall, a lot of grass came back.
And so given that even if people did know and had the time to attempt those repairs in the fall, knowing that they might not have taken, even if people did get around to it, is there anything we can do at this point in the spring?
Yeah, we're getting a little bit late for weed control. Right now, the soil temperatures are up at the point where crabgrass is actively germinating. And so the best time to go out and repair a lawn in the spring was going to be in early spring about a month ago. So people who are doing that might have some good success. But now we're starting to get right into the beginning of summer, and that's usually a really hard time to get things going. So the best approach for that is usually sod. If the air is small enough, you can attempt a seeding, but the chances of it surviving, it's the lowest time of the year because the crabgrass pressure is going to be really high.
So if someone really wants to go with seed instead of sod, maybe they want to wait till the fall at this point?
Yeah, wait till the fall. Every situation is unique. I would say one of the things that the best weed control is actually fertilizer. So keeping that lawn dense is the first key to minimizing the chance that the weeds can come in and invade. If there's not a bare spot, there's not a chance for a new plant to come
because
in.
Because, again, it forms that carpet.
Exactly. So I think when we talk about dandelions coming in everywhere, I don't see at our research station, we see the dandelions where we don't fertilize and where the turf is thin. But the areas that we keep maintained with 2 to 3 applications of fertilizer a year, just a handful of dandelions to the point where you can pick them or spot spray them, and they're pretty easy to manage. But once you lose that density, that's when the weeds can really start to come in.
Those weeds are very opportunistic, aren't they?
Yes.
And so when we're talking about those kinds of weeds, if there's a large patch, actually we had a question on the Facebook page from Andrew. He says, I'm moving into a new house in August, so it sounds like he probably can't do anything at this point anyway. It seems the previous owner loved dandelions. They're so bad you can hardly see grass. So it sounds like he has the opposite. It's not a few spots of dandelions, it's more a few spots of lawn. Instead, the neighbors don't have any and probably would appreciate if I didn't either. Is there something I can do in the fall to discourage them from growing back?
Yeah, so that's great timing, Andrew. The best time to control dandelions is actually in the late fall. So we're talking about October. So a treatment, and I would say when you have complete infestation like that, the best economically and effective treatment is going to use a traditional herbicide with usually a three-way mix. And these often contain 2,4-D dicamba and MCPA, but they can vary. An application of that in the fall is going to be extremely effective. And then the next year, you're going to want to fertilize 2 to 3 times, and you shouldn't need a follow-up application because that fall application should be effective enough where if you keep the density of that lawn up, the few dandelions that come in, you should be able to manage.
Thanks for that question, Andrew. And you can also leave a question on our Facebook page or send us an email at talk@wpr.org. The phone lines are full right now, but you can certainly try a little later at 800-642-1234. Now, you mentioned fertilizing the grass as one of the best ways to keep the weeds under control because they just won't have the opportunity to squeeze their way in. What are some good guidelines for types of fertilizer to use on a lawn? Let's say either those fine fescues or Kentucky bluegrass.
Yeah. So the types of fertilizers available are all over the board. We generally classify them into quick release and slow release. And so quick release fertilizers are going to be immediately available all at once. The grass is going to take it up in a period of a few days. And that the response you'll get from a quick release fertilizer will last maybe only 3 or 4 weeks. So what we like to do is get a mixture of quick and slow release. And a slow release fertilizer can be organic materials are slow release. They're broken down slowly. The nutrients that you apply are converted by soil microorganisms into plant available forms over a period of 4 to 6 weeks. And so the University of Wisconsin likes to recommend a 50-50 mix of quick and slow release for the best quick green up, but also a long lasting response.
So that brings up a question I was going to ask. So those fast release ones are really for that quick response by the grass.
It's a quick response, and it's short lived, which is not really a good mm-hmm. a good combination. So golf course superintendents use quick release fertilizers, but they use them in really small doses, and they use them more frequently. So they're not getting these big spikes. So they're basically using quick release fertilizers in a way that makes them behave like a slow release by putting small amounts of soluble fertilizer. They call it spoon feeding. But if you purchase a slow release fertilizer, it's gonna do that kind of naturally for you.
And those organic fertilizers you were talking about, often you need more of them, right? Because they're not as concentrated.
Right. So you need more product. When we talk about fertilizing lawns, we usually talk in the amount of nitrogen per 1,000 square feet. In a quick-release fertilizer, half of the material in the bag might be the nitrogen, whereas in a slow-release fertilizer, maybe only 5% of the bag. So you would need, 4 or 5 times as many bags to get that same response.
And some fertilizers that I've seen also include an herbicide to help take care of the weeds as well. Do you recommend that, Doug?
Yeah, they have their uses. We call them weed and feed products, and usually the most effective would be if you're looking to control crabgrass, and that application is a bit late right now. But if for controlling dandelions, we actually don't recommend using the weed and feed products. They tend to be less effective than a liquid.
Talking with Doug Soldat, who is Associate Professor of Soil Science at UW-Madison. He teaches, among other things, turf grass management and nutrient and water management. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in today for Larry Mueller on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about lawn control, maintenance, planting, identification, all kinds of lawn topics today with Doug Soldat, who's a soil scientist at the UW-Madison. And we have several people who want to join the conversation, Doug, so let's go to the phones. And Sue in Superior is up first. Hi, Sue.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Good. I had seen a lawn and garden show on TV years ago, and the gal had mentioned naturalizing a lawn. Planting slow-growing native plants to cut down on the chemicals you have to put on and mowing and such. I was wondering if your guest has any idea what that's about.
All right. Thanks for that call, Sue. And I know when Neil DeBole from Prairie Nursery is on, he often talks about that low-mow or no-mow grass that has a lot of – it's a fescue blend,
yep,
basically.
Right. Yeah, so that's a good option. I mean the fine fescues are our lowest maintenance grasses, and they're often sold as low mow or no mow. But they're, when you look on the bag, they're species of fine fescue, and they tend to use less water. They do turn brown early in the summer, and you can get by with either mowing them once per year or burning them back. So they can't, and they don't grow too tall. But I mean, it's not going to look like a lawn in the traditional sense. But yeah, so fine fescues actually are a really nice kind of base for that type of installment. Maybe you want to put bulbs in there too. But If you're looking at mowing just a few times a year, that's the type of grass that you'd want to use.
But it's certainly not going to look like, you said, like a golf course or the outfield of a ball field or something.
Right. Yeah. It's going to have a much more natural look. And so golf courses are doing this in the rough areas, and they're finding, you said, to cut back on the use of chemicals and stuff, but these are tending to be really high maintenance if you want to keep that uniform look. And so it's just like anything else. There are plants that, if you're not mowing, that are going to come in. So mowing is a really good herbicide too, because only a few plants can survive that constant mowing. So when you stop mowing the fine fescue, now you have a whole new host of weeds that you have to figure out some way to control.
And let's talk a little bit about mowing. What are some guidelines for how often, how tall, how to mow, and how the conditions affect that, whether it's like last year with the drought, you know, being extremely hot and dry, or if it's a much cooler, wet spring like we're having now?
Yeah, mowing is the most critical part of how your lawn's going to look. Think about it. It's just a huge stress to the grass. So even though we do it and it's necessary to have that lawn, it's a huge stress. You're creating a wound every time. So the recommendations to get the best impact are to have a very sharp mower blade. And if you look down on your grass a few days after you mow and you see this whitish stringy stuff coming out of the tips, that's a sign of a dull mower. So you want to see a nice clean cut that minimizes the stress on the grass, and you want to have that mowing height 3 inches at least, and cut that grass taller so the roots can grow down deeper.
Am I remembering last year with the hot, dry conditions, you were saying even higher?
Yeah, I mean, if you cut it higher, you're going to send your roots down lower, and it's going to increase the chances of survival. The other thing is, if the grass is starting to wilt and kind of look like it's short on water, don't mow, because mowing is going to increase the water loss from the leaves, and it's going to send a stressed plant even more stressed. Mm. So that's one mistake I see people do often is, you know, it's Friday, it's time to get the mower out, but if the grass is water stressed, it's really not a good idea. And when the grass is water stressed, it stops growing naturally. So stay off the grass when it's really wet with a mower. Stay off the grass when it's really dry. And just remember that it's a stressful event. So you want to try to minimize the stress associated with mowing.
Let's go back to the phones and Gary in Rice Lake. Hi, Gary.
Hello?
Yes.
Yes, it's Gary. I'm up in the Rice Lake, Wisconsin area. And I recently, a few years ago, did some major reconstruction. And so we redid the turf around the house and that, and the soil is pretty heavy clay. We did topsoil it, but what I'm noticing now is the grass and the lawn get very hard, and a lot of times the water just kind of runs off, and I was wondering about aeration, if that would help in the development and strengthening the turf.
All right, and so just to be clear, Gary, so on this clay soil, you already have grass planted?
Yes.
Okay.
It's growing. It's been a couple of years, but it seems that it's getting more clumps and bare spots.
Hmm. Okay.
And the soil is very hard.
Okay. So it sounds, the reason I was asking that is it would probably be hard to do major amendment to the soil if he already has grass on the top.
Established. Yeah. The best time to kind of fix that problem is before the lawn goes in. And to do that, you put either more topsoil down or incorporate some compost into that before you plant the seed. But this is a really, really common problem. So the question is, can you aerate the lawn? And aerate is a practice that you go through and you pull these little half-inch cores out of the ground, half-inch diameter, and about maybe 2, if you're lucky, 3 inches deep.
So basically kind of perforating it.
Yeah, poking holes and pulling out the material and creating some airspace in the soil. So it's absolutely a good practice to do. It's not going to be a long-term solution. So it's going to be like an annual thing that you probably want to do every fall, is go through and have aerate yourself or pay for a service to aerate it, and you should see benefits that last between 6 months and a year from that event. But if you do have deeper compaction, these things are only going down about 2 inches, and you're not, even if you have the best soil in the world in the top 2 inches and really bad stuff underneath, that's still not the ideal condition. But it's definitely going to help improve things a little bit.
And is there anything, you know, like we said, with an established lawn, it's going to be hard for Gary to be able to, you know, really mix anything in deeply. But is there anything that he can kind of top dress that'll work its way down?
Yeah, another way, a little bit more labor intensive. And one thing we do recommend with this situation is using a compost as a top dressing. And after spring and fall applications of compost, we did research on this for about 3 or 4 years, and we actually have another project going now. And when we put down about a half inch of compost on top of the lawn spring and fall for a number of years, we see really, really big improvements in the water infiltration and the density and things like that. So that's another, that's probably a more long-term solution, is to try to get some compost built up on the top of that lawn.
And also, you were saying that, you know, even if you have the best topsoil in the world for those couple inches on the top, if it's not good underneath, what kind of root system, how deep are the root systems of your average lawn?
We were out at a sod farm last week, and we were harvesting sod and taking measurements, and we were getting roots from our Kentucky bluegrass at 18 inches.
18 inches. Wow.
And if you go into a lot of the suburban areas, you're going to find that exact same grass cut from the same sod farm, and its roots are going to be like 3 inches. And that's the soil difference. So
wow.
On the farm, the tillage, the things the farmer's doing to
probably
grow
lots
good
of
roots,
organic matter,
all that stuff, you know, you create the right soil conditions and you can get really deep rooting. But if you're putting sod on top of super compacted, degraded soil, you're not going to get that rooting. So that's the main thing, is to focus on the soil quality.
All right. Thanks for that call, Gary. And let's go to Luba in Madison next. Hi, Luba.
Hi. I have a question about dandelions. Now, I don't use any herbicides or pesticides, and I either dig them out or a deadhead. Now, is there a period when the dandelion does not flower? I know it slows down and it's flowering, but I wondered if there's later in the season, they just don't bloom at all.
Yeah, they do, just like you said, they have this big flush of blooming that occurred about 2 weeks ago here in Madison. And now you can see the flowering's declined. But you're going to see kind of a low, constant level of bloom on dandelions, but it won't be anything like that big flush. And then their leaves kind of shrivel up and go away in late October and into November. And the plant's still alive. It's just kind of in hibernation until the next spring. So you will see a really low level of flowering, but it won't be kind of a coordinated flowering like we see every spring.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Luba. And you can join the conversation as well by calling 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org. Galen Druk is our on-air producer today. He'll be happy to get your calls and emails through to us. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller and talking with Doug Soldat, who is Associate Professor of Soil Science at UW-Madison and a turf grass specialist. Let's go to Bob in Waukesha next. Hi, Bob.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I just wondered if Milorganite would be a good choice for fertilizer for the lawn and for like the garden beds and such.
Yeah, Milorganite is a good choice. It was actually developed at the University of Wisconsin in the 1920s, and our turfgrass research station is named after the O.J. Knorr, who developed Milorganite. So it was specifically formulated or found to be the most effective on lawns and gardens for the nutrient content. So it's got a long history of use, and we've tested it, and we feel it is a good choice for fertilizer.
And what is Milorganite exactly?
Milorganite is the biosolids, is the new term. The old term is sewage sludge, but it's from the city of Milwaukee. So it's highly processed. It has no pathogens, or the heavy metal content is sometimes something that you hear. But the EPA sets really rigorous standards, and Milorganite is orders of magnitude below those tolerances. So it's a high quality product.
And it's often recommended by our UW Extension horticulture experts, I know, and I didn't realize there was that Wisconsin connection.
Yeah, so one thing about a product like Milorganite is it is a waste source, and as we go forward, we need to be more cognizant and more efficient about the way that we reuse our waste, so instead of finding new uses for it. So it's a great fertilizer product. It's good to get two uses out of it.
And it's widely available. I know I've seen it at garden centers and, yep, and things like that. Great. Thanks for that call, Bob. And let's go next to Jackie in Ingleside, Illinois. Hi, Jackie.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
When I was living in Colorado, and it was a drought area, you know, and my friends were using clover as a ground cover for their backyard and front yard. What do you think about doing that here? And I'm in Milwaukee, actually, Bayview area, and I'm wondering, would that work? And who would I touch base with, or who else could I talk to about it?
Well, and Doug, you had mentioned earlier that clovers are considered a turf grass because they form that interlocking.
Yeah. Yeah, clover's got a great history, too. It used to be included in some of Scotts' first seed mixes before chemical fertilizers and pesticides were really available, because they used it as a tool to add nitrogen to the lawn. So clover's a legume, fixes nitrogen from the air, and returns that to the soil and enhances the grass growth. So it all depends on your perspective. And for a while, clover was considered by many to be not a weed and something that should be included in lawns. And then for the next couple decades, it was a weed. And now we're seeing it kind of swing back, that this plant has
benefits. The fashions have changed.
Yeah. And, you know, it doesn't, it's a good component of lawn mixes if it doesn't bother you aesthetically or for other reasons. So we're actually seeing people now start to breed clover for use in lawns. So there's a variety out there called micro clover, and it's really popular in Europe right now, and it's starting to come into the U.S. market. So I know that there's a sod farm in Whitewater that is experimenting with growing Kentucky bluegrass sod with this micro clover mixed in for that purpose. So
Well, and you're saying micro, so I assume there's something small about it. Are they small leaves or low, low growing?
Right. It's bred to be shorter growing and have smaller leaves, so it kind of blends into the lawn better than the forage varieties. But, you know, I've looked at it, and it doesn't look that much different from the clover that I see in lawns. But that said, I guess the answer to your question is you can get this sod in Wisconsin. I'm not sure about the seed yet, but maybe send me an email, and I can do some more research into that for you.
And the easiest way to find you on email?
Yeah, my email is djsoldat, S-O-L-D-A-T, at wisc.edu. Or you can just do a Google search on my name, and I'll come up.
And people can also email talk@wpr.org, and we'll make sure it gets to Doug as well. But yeah, I think of things like, you know, clover for a lawn. It's almost like if you can't beat them, join them, because it's hard to avoid having those things in a lawn. So if you kind of plan for it and use that quick growing and good coverage to your advantage, why not? All right. Thanks for that call, Jackie. Let's go to Jan in Greenville, who it sounds like is dealing with something that I deal with constantly. Hi, Jan.
Hi. Yeah, I've got lots of creeping Charlie. How do I get rid of it?
And creeping Charlie is actually, it's cute, I have to say. Nice little purple flowers. When I moved into my house, I didn't know what it was, and I thought, oh, this is a pretty plant, until it basically took over everything.
It does, yeah. So how do you get rid of creeping Charlie? So the first step is to cut down all the trees in the neighborhood. And no, I'm just kidding. So the main reason when we get creeping Charlie, it tends to be dominate in shady areas. Is that your situation, Jan?
Pretty much.
Yes. Yeah. So the reason it's there is because the grass isn't, grass evolved in, you know, we'd say a grassland. You think of no trees, open, full sun. And that's the case with our turf grasses. They need and they like full sun. Creeping Charlie's the opposite. It's an understory plant. So you're basically trying to take a less competitive species, your lawn, and outcompete the creeping Charlie. So it's a losing battle. So that's the ecology of it. In terms of how you manage it, the best way we can recommend to manage it is to apply an herbicide containing triclopyr in the late fall, so in the October window. And then if that doesn't take care of it, then a follow-up application in the spring when you see those purple flowers. So chemically, that's the best strategy. But again, it's if the growing conditions aren't right for the lawn, that's the reason the creeping Charlie keeps coming back. It's just extremely well adapted to those shady situations when grass really struggles in those environments.
And the reason it's called creeping Charlie is that it spreads.
Yeah, it has stolons or runners.
Yeah.
So it just creeps really quickly right over the lawn and can, or over any ground cover. It sends down new roots. And when you when you do try to control it chemically, it's very hard because it has all these stolons everywhere. And if you don't even get one little node, it's going to start again. So it's sort of a constant battle.
It's similar to how strawberries with the runners.
Exactly.
And stuff,
right. Just like strawberries. So I'll say in our turfgrass research center, we don't have trees, right? And everybody talks about how hard Creeping Charlie is to control. It is not difficult to control at our research station because the ecology is flipped. Full sun, Creeping Charlie is not going to be competitive with the grass. So it's all about that environment.
I have to say, even though you know you're not getting it all, it's so satisfying when you pull it and you feel all these little pop, 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 pop when you're when you're ripping up all those little suckers. But it is amazingly quick growing and spreading and hardy and, Yeah, I feel your pain, Jan, very much. Well, let's go next to Valerie in Grafton. Hi, Valerie.
Hi there. We spotted our lawn last year, and we had some spots that died off, and then the rest of it wasn't doing very well. So we're just wondering what the best way to take care of the lawn is now and how to best reseed those areas that completely died.
Yeah, so if you can, how big are your dead areas?
Some of them are pretty big, about a piece of sod, and some of them are smaller. So.
Okay, so that's good news. The smaller ones probably will start to fill in over the summer. You might have to watch the weeds in those patches and make sure that the weeds aren't coming in. But if it's sod, it's Kentucky bluegrass. And that's when the growing conditions are good, that grass can move really grow really quickly, like fill in a dinner size plate in a month or two. The larger spots, so what I'm going to say is just try to ride out the year, watch the weed content in those bare spots, make sure that the weeds aren't taking over, fertilize it right about now, and then if we're not dormant, if the grass is still green, try again around July. And then the best time to seed will be late August, early September. And at that time, there's not many weeds coming in. It's a perfect time for growing grass. And then the seedlings should take over those bare spots that are left.
Okay, perfect. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Valerie. And you can join us as well by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We do have lines open, so you can ask your question of Doug Soldat, who is a turfgrass specialist at UW-Madison, and we would be happy to have you join the discussion. And Anne posted a question and a photo on the Facebook page. She says, I have trouble keeping grass on the north side of my garage under a tree. So that's really going to those issues you said with shade, Doug. It doesn't even get enough light to satisfy the shade grass mixes we've tried. Yeah. Any suggestions?
Yeah. So just looking at the picture with the hostas and the shade, I mean, yeah, that's the classic spot where we try to grow grass and it just doesn't work. The shady mixes are the fine fescues, and those are going to be the best option. The other thing I could recommend, so is that area, if that area is wet at all, or, you know, it doesn't look like a dry shade, but if it does have moisture or keeps wet, there's a really rare grass called Poa supina, or supina bluegrass, that has runners just like the Creeping Charlie, and it does good in shady, wet conditions that you might want to try. And looking at that situation, I think it might be worth a shot. So Poa supina, P-O-A space, S-U-P-I-N-A, Poa supina or supina bluegrass. It's hard to find. Again, shoot me an email, or maybe I'll reply on this when I get off the show and show you where you can get it.
Great. And when you say wet, Doug, I'm assuming you're not talking about like
no, not
soggy,
like,
but just that it gets regular.
Generally moist. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
All right. Great. And we had an email from Donna. She asks, can a lawn be maintained using only organic methods, no herbicides or synthetic fertilizers?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The key is what the soil's like. So if you have a really good soil, you have a really good growing environment, and you have the right grass, it's actually not too challenging to not use the synthetic chemicals. The problem is most of our sites don't have those conditions. So the pest control is the weakest link of an organic based program, but no synthetic fertilizers is actually pretty easy because we have a huge long list of organic fertilizers. And like I said, fertilization is really a big component of the weeds that come in. So if
because the healthier the lawn is, the less opportunity for the weeds.
Right. So if you start with a really good soil, you have the right grass, and you maintain it with an organic fertilizer, and then you're picking the few weeds that come up. So it can be done, but having all those conditions at once is challenging.
And what are some good places to find those organic solutions?
There's a long list of them. Actually, Wisconsin, with our agricultural background, there's a lot of fertilizers that we've tested over the years that are made in Wisconsin, and they're certified organic for lawns.
And we do have a link on the Facebook page, too. Let me just pull this up. Lawn resources from the Learning Store, the UW Extension Learning Store. And there are actually some in Spanish as well. And things like do-it-yourself, alternative lawn care, how to sample garden soils and lawn soil tests, things like that, turf grass nutrient management, planning, all kinds of great resources for our listeners and the lawn owners.
Probably the most relevant one up there at the Learning Store is called Lawn Establishment and Renovation.
Oh, okay.
And that one will help you with all your seeding questions and repairing dead spots. So good resource there.
Great. And let's go to Nancy in Menominee Falls next. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. Good morning.
Hi.
My question is, how do you get rid of anthills in your lawn? I have an anthill that I have had for 2-3 years, and it bothers me when I see it in the spring. So I take out about 2 or 3 gallons of hot boiling water and pour over it, and then I kind of try and heal the scar the rest of the summer, but it always comes back in the spring. So I'm just wondering if there's a better way. I didn't really want to put pesticide on it because I didn't know what other good things I might be killing.
Are these the big black ants?
No, these are not the big black ones.
What kind are they?
Well, they're smaller black ones.
Okay. But they're not red ants, I guess. Doug, you were just talking about how hard it is that the pest control is kind of the weak link in organic approaches.
Yeah, this is out of my area. I would say there probably are some non-conventional methods to do this, but I just don't know. This is we have Chris Williamson of UW Extension, or Phil Pelletieri, who would be much, much better at answering your question than I would. So let's just make sure that you get an answer, Nancy.
Why don't you send, if you can, Nancy, send an email to talk@wpr.org, and I'll make sure that it gets forwarded on to one of those entomologists.
Okay. The hot water does kind of...
I would get...
Your sadistic side.
So in general, ants, it's all about getting the queen. So mm-hmm. There's a lot of methods out there that will get back the workers. But if the queen is alive, they're going to come back. So a lot of the most effective, like, long-term solutions deal with getting at the queen.
Mm-hmm. And I know, actually, Phil was on not too long ago, and he talked about he was talking about using pesticides, but yeah, that you want to
bait.
You want to stick a rod or a stick. I think he said three, like as far down as you can go, even 3 feet if you can, kind of wiggle it so there's a hole and then pour it down because those queens are way down underground. They're well protected.
Right.
And now Nancy's boiling water solution, is that possibly doing any damage to the grass?
Not long term, I guess probably. Nothing more than the ants are doing immediately.
Well, good luck with that, Nancy, and we'll try to get some more information for you. And actually, Jill and Rhinelander, it looks like, might have an idea on those very same ants. Hi, Jill.
Hi. There's a thing that you can try. It's diatomaceous earth.
Oh, okay. And how do you apply that?
You just sprinkle it around where the ants go, and what it is. You know what diatomaceous earth is?
Why don't you explain it for our listeners?
Okay. It's diatoms that are ground up, so they end up being sharp little shards, and they will lacerate the ant bodies and dehydrate them. They don't hurt other critters. I mean, it's a very fine powder, and they'll drag it back into the nest. And, I mean, it works for me.
All right. Well, thanks for that suggestion. And Doug, is diatomaceous earth something that you're familiar with or use?
I know I've heard it used before, but again, this is just something that I don't have experience studying with, but that's a great suggestion, Jill.
Yeah. All right. Thanks so much. As is often the case, one listener helps out another.
Yeah.
And Doug Soldad is here helping all of us out. He's an associate professor of soil science at UW-Madison. He teaches, among other things, turf grass nutrient and water management. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller today on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Monday at 11, Peter Green of Infostar.com will be here with advice for fixing issues you may be having with Windows 8. He'll also share his current top 10 list of useful websites. Lots of great computer advice on Monday at 11 with Peter Green. And lots of great lawn advice right now with Doug Soldat from UW-Madison. He's a soil scientist, and he teaches and studies turf grass. And he's happy to help you with your lawn problems when you join us at 1-800-642-1234. And let's go to Wally in Monona next. Hi, Wally.
Yeah, hi. I have a question regarding no mowing lawn. You, a few minutes ago, mentioned the fine fescue, but what about Pennsylvania sedge? I heard that would be another option.
All right. Pennsylvania sedge, Doug, is that something that you're familiar with?
Yeah, I have to admit that this is a new one. Sedges, it sounds like it's probably for a wet area. Usually sedges occur when the soil's wet. And so it probably makes sense if that's your situation. If you have a drier situation, the fine fescue is going to dominate. But I don't know anything about the Pennsylvania sedge. Apologize.
Uh-huh. Is that for a wet area that you're looking at it, Wally?
No, it's for a dry area.
Oh.
My guess is a fine fescue is going to be a really good option, but I'll check into that. Yeah, if you can contact me by email, we'll see if I can look into it for you.
And, you know, Wally used the term no-mo, which I know, for instance, Neil DeBull at Prairie Nursery has no-mo and low-mo. But is there really a true no-mo lawn, or it's just that you almost never have to do it?
Yeah, I don't think it's anything such as no-mo, because it's going to be some mo or low-mo. But no-mo is usually when we plant these grasses and just let them go without any type of mowing or burning, or they degrade pretty quickly. They get thatchy, they get puffy, weeds come in. So you do need that some type of maybe once or twice a year to maintain them.
Because it's not just for the grasses themselves, it's for what else might be trying to grow around them.
Right.
All right. Yep. Thanks for that call, Wally. And let's go to John in Green Bay. Hi, John.
Good morning. We live on a cul-de-sac, and because we have a small front yard, you'd think it'd be easy to take care of, but it's almost all pure sand. The previous owner had excellent lawn, but it was only with heavy inputs of fertilizer and heavy watering, and we've decided we weren't going to do that. Consequently, we don't have much of a lawn. We're planning on fixing that problem this August by having a soil business come in and replace either 4 to 6 inches of our soil with some, you know, good topsoil, and I want to make sure that you think that that's a good idea.
All right.
Yeah, that's outstanding. 4 to 6 inches, I think. 6 inches is really, really good. 4 is pretty good. So that's going to solve a lot of your moisture problems, I think. And also should give you a longer time interval between fertilization events. So I think that is an ideal solution for your problem.
And, you know, it sounds like John has been regretting that he hasn't had a better looking lawn, but because he has the chance to really kind of start fresh, that's ideal, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I wish we had the opportunity to make changes like that more often. You know, you look at the housing codes and all the things that are required to build the house, but you go outside of the house and there's nothing. If we could just get those lawns with 6 inches of topsoil every time, make a huge difference on the environmental impact and where the water goes and infiltrates. So
it sounds like Becky in Escanaba, Michigan also had a kind of start from scratch. So let's go there. Hi, Becky.
Hi.
Hi. What's going on with your lawn?
Well, a few years ago, we had grubs. Last summer, we took out the front lawn, got rid of everything, brought in new topsoil, hydroseeded, got that all taken care of. It was a huge project. our backyard is our bigger area, and we still have huge dirt patches from those grubs. And it's where the kids play. It's where we have a lot of activities. We hate to go through the whole trouble again. Is there an easier way to try and get that grass to come back, or do we need to start from scratch with that damage?
Yeah, it's hard to say. It's hard to sit here in the studio and give you the best recommendation that you need. But I would say in general, if you can get some compost there and a rototiller and kind of work up those dead areas and then put down some seed this fall, like I said, right now is not a good time to attempt it. So if you can keep weeds out the best you can right now, fertilize the grass that's there and try to get that healthy and thick, and then come mid to late August, start looking at getting a truckload of compost and then a rototiller, mixing that up, kind of disturbing that soil, and then putting down some seed and mulch on top of that. That's probably going to be your best option.
You know, we've got really healthy grass around those patches. It kind of looks like it's got the mange. And so if we can keep that other grass healthy and keep those grubs out of that.
Yeah, it'll spread. That healthy grass, if it's healthy, that's the key, because then that grass will start to spread. And those areas that look really big now will look a little bit smaller when you go to seed. And some of them might even start closing up altogether.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Becky. I know grubs can be a real problem for lawns. What are some of the signs of grub damage?
Grub damage looks an awful lot like water damage, because the grubs are eating the roots. So, and often they're chewing on the roots when it's wet out, mm-hmm. and you don't see that moisture stress. And then the summer hits, and we get this heat and the drought, and then the grass has no roots, and then it goes downhill really, really quickly. So often, if you do have a history of grub problems, the best time to treat for grubs is right about the 4th of July. And that's when the adults lay their eggs, and they're most susceptible to the insecticide. There's not much we can do about the grubs now, because they overwintered, they're big, they're fat, they're chewing on those roots, and you kind of wait to see the damage.
And again, that turf of the interlocking carpet makes it hard to get to them or even know that they're there.
Yeah, right. So a lot of times we make the recommendation based on the history of the area. And some places we never see them. So
are there some turf varieties that are less susceptible or less tasty to the grubs?
No, not to the point where we think it would make a better recommendation to switch from Kentucky bluegrass. So unfortunately, no. There's some grasses that will dissuade surface feeders, but again, the negatives of those grasses don't outweigh the positives of Kentucky bluegrass.
All right. And let's go to Pat in Eau Claire next. Hi, Pat.
Yeah, hi. Wonderful show. Thank you.
Sure.
We're enjoying it. Hey, and I apologize, we just tuned in about a half hour ago, and if I'm asking a redundant question, then I'll just move on. But we have a dog, and we feed our birds and things like that. And we've had various, companies over the years that have taken care of our lawn and fertilized and this type of thing. But we were just wondering if your guest could recommend perhaps a website or just any suggestions that we might look at. Because what happens is when our lawn is serviced, it just really bothers to see the birds up there. And we're very watchful for our dog, and we wipe her feet off and things like that.
But sure.
If you might have a suggestion, what direction we might go, we'd sure appreciate it.
Sure. So fertilizers that minimize any harm to wildlife or domestic life.
Yeah. So fertilizers generally are safe for animals and wildlife. Usually we hear those concerns more about the herbicides and insecticides. So I guess I would say if that's your concern, you can find a lawn care company and eliminate the pesticide application from your plan. But the fertilization should not be causing any problems to the birds or the wildlife or the dog or the feet. I mean, it's nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium. So these things are nutrients that our body uses, so that they don't tend to have a toxicity profile associated with them.
And as you were mentioning earlier as well, Doug, there are, if someone's really concerned, there are alternatives that are organic for fertilizers especially.
Yeah, right. Well, the organic fertilizers contain the same nutrients, and but often you're putting down more material. So sometimes we hear about people's dogs getting into the organic fertilizer and making a mess. So actually, in terms of the amount of material you put down, I might think a synthetic fertilizer might be a better option than an organic one. But again, I don't really have concerns about either one of them. If you are worried about something or you're noticing something, it might be more associated with the chemical application that went down.
And in general, when you do apply fertilizer, is that something that you then want to water to make sure it gets worked in soon, or do you just wait until...
It depends.
In my rain.
Yeah, it depends on the product. In general, you can't go wrong with watering afterwards, so that would be one practice to do. So the put down the fertilizer, turn on the lawn sprinklers for 15 minutes or so. It's not necessary.
All right. We're talking with Doug Soldot. He is Associate Professor of Soil Science at UW-Madison. He teaches, among other things, turfgrass nutrient and water management. And he's been offering some great advice about taking care of our lawns, dealing with damage from last year's drought and maybe this year's flooding. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. And this is Garden Talk on your Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. A nice lawn can be the frame around a home or around a colorful garden, but to keep it looking good and thriving, it does take a fair amount of attention. Hi, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in today for Larry Mueller on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Doug Soldot is with us today to offer advice on how to decide what kind of lawn we want and what kind of turf grasses might be best for our growing conditions. And he can help us limit the amount of chemicals and even water that we need as well. Doug's an associate professor of soil science at UW-Madison, and he teaches, among other things, turfgrass nutrient and water management. And thanks again for spending time with us today, Doug.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks, Judith.
And it's clear that a lot of people have questions about how to take good care of their lawn, judging from the number of phone calls and emails and Facebook posts, but we certainly have room for you as well. If you'd like to join in, you can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or send us an email at talk@wpr.org. And let's go right to the phones and Steve in Madison. Hi, Steve.
Hello.
What's going on with your lawn?
I have a question about slip seeding. I'm in a condominium, and our landscape company did some slip seeding on the 23rd of May, so a little over a week ago. And first, I don't understand the process because it looked like they just threw the seed on top of the lawn, but there were little furrows about 1 inch, you know, apart. You know, some machine did that, but nothing is happening. I don't see any grass coming up.
Did you say a week ago?
The 23rd, they did it.
23rd.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's not too unusual. So slit seeding is I think the term that I'm familiar with, and that's when you indeed cut these little slits in the soil. Some machines will put the seed right into the slit, and it sounds like in your case, they had a machine that would cut the slits, and then they went over the top and broadcast the seed, hoping that some of it will fall into the slits. So that's actually our recommended method for seeding in the spring, because it does minimize the disturbance to the soil. But part of the success of getting seed to come up is to have it in contact and buried by the soil. And that's one good sort of non-invasive way to do that. It's not surprising at all that you haven't seen anything after a week. The soil temperatures are still in the 60s, which is still pretty chilly. They are going to germinate, but Kentucky bluegrass can take 21 to 28 days just to germinate.
Wow.
So this is one of the problems with Kentucky bluegrass, is it takes a long time for that seed to show up into a grass plant. Now, the fine fescues and perennial ryegrass, which are probably a component of that mix, will come up in at earliest 7 to 10 days. So you should probably just right about now be seeing little tiny seedlings coming up. But if they did 100% Kentucky bluegrass, which would be a good choice, it still may be a couple weeks before that would come up.
Now, Steve is saying that they laid down that seed about a week ago, and certainly in the last few days in Madison, and that's where Steve is, we've gotten some really, really strong rains and lots of rain in a very short amount of time. What might that have done to the seeding that they did?
Yeah, so that's a benefit of the slit seeding, because by just creating that little slit, you don't have seed that can be washed off the surface in mass. So that seed that was put down and is buried in those slits should be protected and should be okay, given the rain.
All right. Thanks for that call, Steve. And Shirley in Eau Claire is next. Hi, Shirley.
Hi.
So what's going on with your lawn?
Oh, I have mold problems, and it looks like my lawn has varicose veins.
Okay, so you've got mold actually growing on the grass?
Not mold, little critters, mold.
Moles.
Oh, moles. Okay. So that would explain the varicose veins. So so moles in the lawn.
So again, this is into the animal side of things usually, for me, so a little bit of a stretch. But my guess is probably voles with a V, or meadow mice. And these guys, under the snow, they create these little tunnels, and they chew through the stems of the grass and the varicose veins. It sounds a lot like voles or meadow mice. They are extremely difficult to control because they breed prolifically. Like they have offspring and they just reproduce and they're everywhere. There are some home remedies to try them to control them, but really the bottom line is that damage that you're seeing now, the lawn will grow back. The Kentucky bluegrass will fill in those little tunnels. You can do your best to smooth them out with your feet, or just kind of tamp down those little tunnels. But usually that damage does go away. And I think at the Learning Store, there is a publication that deals with voles in your lawn. But again, the control is not going to be 100% effective. One way you can trap them, there are devices you can pound into the ground that create a vibration that discourages them. They don't like the noise. So there's a lot of things like that you can try. But again, the control of these guys are hard because they reproduce so many generations.
And again, the Learning Store is a great resource, not just on gardening, but they have more gardening publications than I can even count. It's learningstore.uwex for UW Extension.edu. Again, learningstore.uwex.edu. And there is a link from our Facebook page that goes directly to a search for lawn resources, but from there you can do a search for anything you want, including voles. So just to be clear, Doug, you were saying that it's not like the grubs that are actually eating the roots of the grass. The voles are just kind of making a mess underground, but
yeah,
it's not
right. They actually chew on the grass itself, and they'll eat some of the grass, and they'll eat your ornamentals, but they create those little tunnels as their transportation system.
All right. Well, let's go to Mark in New London next. Hi, Mark.
Hi, I got a question in regards to dethatching the lawn. I dethatch it every spring, and this year there's still a layer of thatch down, and the grass just isn't thickening up all that much. And my question is, should I just leave that layer that's still there to decompose, and then, you know, as the weather warms up here, the grass will just start to thicken up naturally, or should I fertilized once this year. I just fertilized about a week ago with a combination of weed killer and fertilizer. Should I maybe in a few more weeks add a little bit more nitrogen to the soil to try and boost the grass and get it to thicken up? Because that's the primary way I like to try and fight the weeds off in the yard, is by thickening up the grass.
By keeping it dense. Yeah, so thatch it's a problem that I see less and less over time.
And what is thatch?
So thatch is it's a layer of usually woody type stems. So grass is always producing leaves, and those leaves die back constantly, but we see them mostly over winter, and they turn brown and they can leave a layer. I'm not too worried about the ones that just feel like dead leaves, soft. But when you start to feel like woody stems, and it's about a half inch to an inch thick, and it's just rough and it's prickly, that's when we recommend dethatching. That used to be a bigger problem probably in the 1980s when fertilizer rates were a lot higher. So one way you can create that layer is by fertilizing too much, I would say. So now I think a lot of the dethatching that goes on is probably unnecessary. And we see it, people doing it in the spring to get rid of this brown layer, but that'll go away naturally. So I would say my guess is that a lot of that stuff is just still some dead leaves from the spring. So, and right now is a really bad time to dethatch because the weeds, the other weeds are getting going, even though you just put down a weed killer. It's I think it's too damaging. So you already fertilized just a bit ago. I think we've had kind of a cold, wet spring. My advice would be just sit back a little bit and see what happens. We might just be a couple weeks behind what you're normally used to seeing. But I wouldn't recommend dethatching now. If you do think you still have a thick thatch layer with that's kind of prickly and stemmy, I would tackle that in the fall and do that about the time that you're going to put down your last fertilizer application, like mid to late September.
So, Doug, basically right now that layer of dead material is actually kind of creating a smother for any weeds that are trying to come up. So
yeah.
That's why it wouldn't be a good time to take it off right now.
Yeah, when you do take it up, you expose the soil and it gives you make these gaps for the weeds to come in. So, Mark, I wouldn't recommend going at it again, and I would even hold off on the fertilizer for another month or so too.
Okay, I have one other quick question for you. I live in an old Christmas tree farm, and a lot of times the blades of grass will turn yellow and get little black spots on them when they start to mature. And I haven't been able to identify what's causing that and what that problem is. And I think that's one of the reasons why the lawn just never really thickens up. And the lawn's about 10 years old.
Okay. So that's not, to me, that sounds like a disease pathogen we call leaf spot. We have a turf grass diagnostic lab at the University of Wisconsin that will handle homeowner submissions. They charge a $20 fee, but if you send in a sample to them and they have a webpage, just Google turf grass diagnostic lab, Wisconsin or something like that, and that'll come right up. And they can actually give you an accurate diagnosis and a recommendation for how to deal with it. So that's my best guess on that one.
All right. Very good. Thanks.
Good luck.
Thanks for that call, Mark. And actually, I just looked that up really quickly. And Turfgrass Diagnostic Lab, it's www.plantpath, like plant pathology, I'm guessing, plantpath.wisc.edu, /TDL, I think it is. Yeah,
yep.
Turfgrass Diagnostic Lab. All right. Yeah. We'll put a link for that up on the Facebook page for people to be able to follow. But that's great to know because I knew that there was a plant disease diagnostic lab and the insect diagnostic lab and now a turfgrass one. So that's great. Let's go next to Garrett in Green Bay. Hi, Garrett.
Hi. My house is in Oconto.
All right.
13 years ago, I moved in. 7 years prior to that, there was no maintenance on the lawn. It just grew wild for 7 years. And it's populated by a few white pines, but mostly Scotch pines. So I have about 1 to 2 inches of basically rotted pine needles. And over the past 13 years, I put in Mallorganite a few times. But I really haven't done anything else. I've been trying to call you guys and finally got through, finally.
Well, congratulations. Now, Garrett, is there also a lot of shade from those pine trees?
I took out a lot of the pine, so it's probably about 30% shaded right now. But even where there is sun, there's just so much pine needles, you know, other than tilling it, which I don't really want to till the whole lawn.
Oh, boy. That's what I was going to say.
You just said you don't want to do what Doug was going to recommend.
Yeah, I was thinking this is a tough situation. And I was thinking, boy, what can I say? And I say, well, I think probably the best thing to do would be to till it up at a deep level and incorporate those pines back into that subsoil. But if you don't want to do that, what's the next best thing? Huh? Yeah, it's just going to be a constant struggle to grow those grass seeds, right? And especially if you've got a 2-inch layer of those decomposed needles, that can be a really tough growing environment. I don't know if it's much easier, but bringing in some sort of compost or some sort of maybe even a topsoil layer. And anytime you do layering in soils, you create more problems than you tend to solve. So, I mean, I really, really like the rototilling or the tillage option for this. If you want to have success, otherwise I think you're just going to be messing around and not happy with your results for a while.
How about some sort of a major aerating?
Yeah, the aerating is tough because you're really only affecting maybe 10% of the surface area, and those tines, those aeration tines, are only going to go down 2 to 3 inches. So you're just kind of penetrating into that that decomposed pine needle layer. And I think what you really want to do is mix that layer in with the maybe 4 inches below it and kind of dilute it out and kind of change the growing medium.
All right, well, maybe I'll just go a section at a time and do as you say and just start rototilling it.
Yeah, maybe a section at a time, and that'll give you an idea if it's going to be worth your while, if you like the results.
Perfect. Well, thank you for your help. Have
all right.
Day.
Thanks, Garrett.
Good luck, Garrett.
Now, I know that pine needles, it sounds like a really large quantity of pine needles like Garrett has. Could that throw off the pH?
Yeah, usually the pine needles and the organic material in general, when that decomposes, that's going to leave a pretty acidic environment. But it's also, when you have pure organic matter like that, it changes the way that the water behaves and the soil dries out quickly or maybe becomes hydrophobic and won't re-wet, or there's just a whole host of problems with those thick organic layers.
All right. And how sensitive is turf grass to variations in pH?
Actually, it's one of the more tolerant plants. I think turf grass can tolerate pH anywhere from 5.5 up to 8.5.
Wow, that's a big range.
Yeah, we don't really worry about adjusting pH here in Wisconsin at all. But in this case, the low pH of the pine needle layer is probably one factor of many that are giving Garrett trouble.
All right. And Donna in Madison is up next, so let's go there. Hi, Donna.
Hi, this is Donna, right. I guess I have the same kind of problem that the fellow that called named Mark. My front yard is probably 12 by 12 feet of turf. Well, I can get down on my hands and knees and roll it kind of up. There's weeds growing through it, however. And I don't know if I should hire a guy to do a rototilling or what I should do with it.
So, Donna, you're saying that the grass is really not even connected to the ground anymore, that you can roll it up?
Yeah, you're right. And okay. It takes a little doing, but it comes up anyway. But I can't. I'm down on my hands and knees to do it, and I'm old.
All right. So what would you recommend for Donna? It sounds like the grass that she has in place is pretty much a done deal at this point.
Yeah. Anytime you can roll up the grass, it sounds like a grub issue or something that's eating the roots, because usually those roots anchor that grass really, really strongly to the soil, and that's one of the tests we do to tell if it's grub damage, is just pull up on it. And if you pull up and it comes off really easy, it's a clear sign of something that's feeding on the roots. So you said you can't seed it because of the weeds that are in there?
There are some weeds, but some of it is just blank, you know.
Yeah.
But the thing is that I think if you seed into it, it wouldn't even take. I don't know. I mean, with that top layer like that.
Yeah, yeah.
It must be.
No, you're exactly right. Yeah, anytime you do a seeding, you want to prepare the soil. And it sounds like because you have this kind of mix of some weeds and some grass that's weakly attached and some bare areas, probably the best thing to do is have that tilled up and mixed together and made into a uniform seed bed. And then I don't see a problem with getting the seeds to germinate, other than the fact that we're already almost into June here, and you know, crabgrass is going to be germinating, everything's going to be competing with it. So if it's small enough, maybe purchasing some sod and sodding those areas.
How big an area is that, Donna, that you're dealing with?
Well, I would say 12 feet square, probably.
Okay.
Yeah, that sounds like a perfect situation for sod. So if you can get that, have somebody till that up for you and install some sod, you're going to have instant ground cover on that area. And then it might be a good idea to think about grub control.
Actually, I was going to ask, Doug, because you said it sounds like when you can pull it up like that, I mean, should Donna be checking to make sure she's not basically putting a nice new layer of sod on top of a bunch of grubs who are just going to start eating again?
Right. Well, my guess is that the grubs are going to come in into adults and leave, and you might not find them in the soil. But what you want to do is prevent the new generation from killing that grass. So July is usually a good time for that application. But if you're pulling up the grass, it's a pretty clear sign that you have a problem.
All right. Thanks for that call, Donna, and good luck with that. And let's go next to Mark in Waterloo, Iowa. Hi, Mark.
Good afternoon. Interesting program.
Great.
I have a couple of issues. I'll just go to start on one. Crabgrass is my current nemesis in the backyard, Colton. In another part of my yard, I've done lasagna-type composting to enrich the soil. I'm going to be replanting there. But I'm wondering if because I'm concerned about the microorganisms and earthworms, I don't really want to use anything to kill crabgrass. So if I just smother with cardboard, how effective do you see that being going forward?
That's a cool solution. I've not done cardboard before, but we've done black plastic, like a plastic bag, and that will heat up and kill the grass really quickly. My guess is cardboard would work too. I mean, you're excluding the light, but you're still allowing for some gas exchange. So that should work for you.
And actually, that has come up as a solution for a variety of issues, wanting to create a new garden bed or things like that. And at least one of our guests in the past has suggested, I think it was Neil DeBull, actually, from Prairie Nursery, suggested getting to be friends with the local appliance store and asking for, say, a big box that, refrigerator came in, or a washer dryer or something, so you get that really good coverage.
Yeah, that big, thick stuff, right? And they might be happy. They don't have to break it down.
Yeah.
So.
Did you have another quick comment or question, Mark?
Just quickly, how long do you think it's going? Because I just started this within the week. How long do you think I need to leave it down to make sure that bastardly stuff is truly dead?
Oh, boy. Yeah, that's hard to say. I think with crabgrass, it's germinating right now. So, and it kind of the seeds don't all germinate at once. So right now I would say the longer you can leave it on, the better, because as soon as you take it off, if there's a seed that hasn't germinated, it's going to come up and start forming a new plant. So at this time of the year, the longer you can leave it on, the better.
I would actually say through the whole growing season.
Yeah.
If you can. I mean, if it's not too unsightly or something.
Well, right. And I mean, the best time to reseed is going to be in the fall.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. So leave it on for a few months if you're able to. Well, Doug, in just the minute we have left here. So right now, not a good time for doing seeding. But what should we be doing, say, in June for our lawns?
Yeah, so June, like I said, one of the best defenses, or two of the best defenses against weeds, is mowing properly. So mow your grass high, keep a sharp mower blade. Don't mow when it's very wet. Don't mow when it's very dry. Mow it regularly. We always talk about this thing called the one-third rule, which says don't ever remove more than one-third of the grass blade at a time. That's a very stressful event to remove more than a third. So that means you have to mow it more frequently. But those are going to improve the plant health. And that's one thing that's going to help the grass fill in, cover in those smaller bare spots. And the next thing you want to do is keep your fertility.
All right. Doug Soldat from the UW-Madison soil scientist and lawn turf grass and lawn specialist. Doug, always great to have you with us.
Thanks, Judith.
And you've been listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks to Galen Druk for on-air production today. And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Stay tuned for other great programming on the Ideas Network.
Do you remember the first time you listened to Wisconsin Public Radio? You probably didn't know it at the time, but that first program you heard was made possible thanks to other listeners. Their financial support made it possible for you to discover WPR. Return the favor. Make your first ever contribution today. Go to WPR.org and click donate, or call 800-383-9772.